So we're moving along tonight. We open a new chapter, chapter 9, newly this is the release from the ego. It appeared at the beginning of volume 3 in the Arya. This was the commencement of the third year of its publication. On his birthday, 15 August 1960, and it was chapter 21 in that series. It's interesting here. This issue has him opening with the life divine, the knot of matter. And then, obviously, this chapter, the release from the ego in the synthesis of yoga. But also in this issue, he begins the series, The Psychology of Social Development. And he opens his discussion on the Gita with the first essays. Essays on the Gita, our demand and need from the Gita. So, in this very issue, he gets to the root of the evolving universe's unfoldment, tracking its evolution towards the discovery in these essays on social science, measuring out the terms of what is the emerging group soul as it seeks for truth. And then in the Gita, he offers the fullest picture, a Vedanta. This is a world-affirming, resonant path that the Gita offers, fusing knowledge with the sense of offering the dynamic work one does. But absolutely here, no one is permitted, no one is encouraged to leave, but to do the work, setting an example to hold the worlds together, part of the point of the Gita. So this issue, The Life Divine, Psychology of Social Development, Essays on the Gita, and of course, our synthesis of yoga. And here he's talking about the big picture of knowledge. In recent chapters, he's been taking us from level to level. What it is that we must release ourselves from. Ignoring what we essentially are has led to ignorance housed in the bodily consciousness, has led to ignorance concealed, secured, defending ourselves and our emotions. And now, having said, the questing soul has to go beyond all of these, brings us to the nature of the ego. So we see the body and the senses, we see vitality, the pranic nature, and now we see the ahankara, the I-making nature of the illusory ego, pulled into focus. So, before we begin, I wanted to read to you how this chapter opened in the Arya, the first sentence. And then you'll see how he rephrased it. And in fact, this chapter has been thoroughly reworked. The last several that we've gone through, he didn't touch, he didn't revise them. This one, he spent some time on. So the Arya opened in this essay with the formation of the conscious ego is the first great labor of the cosmic life in its progressive evolution. The loosening of the knot of the ego is the condition on which alone life can arrive at its divine fruition. The formation of the conscious ego. Let's see how he redescribes this now. We open the chapter. The formation of a mental and vital ego tied to the body sense was the first great labor of the cosmic life in its progressive evolution. For this was the means it found for creating out of matter a conscious individual. So in the beginning, in the Arya, he takes it that the conscious ego is the conscious individual. Here, he discriminates between the two, separates the one from the other. The ego is that which the conscious individual, as it grows, uses as a mask to interface with the world. The dissolution of this limiting ego is the one condition, the necessary means for this very same life to arrive at its divine fruition. For only so can the conscious individual find either his transcendent self or his true person. And we'll be talking a lot about this in coming pages, because he will bring into picture the distinction between the ego and the jivatman and its powerful implications for our lives. This double movement is usually represented as a fall and a redemption, or a creation and a destruction, the kindling of a light and its extinction, or the formation first of a smaller temporary and unreal self, and a release from it into our true self's eternal largeness. For human thought falls apart towards two opposite extremes. One, mundane and pragmatic, regards the fulfillment and satisfaction of the mental, vital, and physical ego sense, individual or collective, as the object of life and looks no farther. While the other, spiritual, philosophic, or religious, regards the conquest of the ego in the interests of the soul, spirit, or whatever be the ultimate entity, as the one thing supremely worth doing. Even in the camp of the ego, there are two divergent attitudes which divide the mundane or materialist theory of the universe. One tendency of this thought regards the mental ego as a creation of our mentality, which will be dissolved with the dissolution of mind by the death of the body. The one abiding truth is eternal nature working in the race, this or another, and her purpose should be followed, not ours. The fulfillment of the race, the collective ego, and not that of the individual should be the rule of life. Another trend of thought, more vitalistic in its tendencies, fixes on the conscious ego as the supreme achievement of nature, no matter how transitory. Ennobles it into a human representative of the will to be, and holds up its greatness and satisfaction as the highest aim of our existence. And here you have notes, overtones of Nietzsche and Bergson. In the more numerous systems that take their stand on some kind of religious thought or spiritual discipline, there is a corresponding divergence. The Buddhist denies the existence of a real self or ego, admits no universal or transcendent being. The Advaitin declares the apparently individual soul to be none other than the supreme self and Brahman, its individuality an illusion. The putting off of individual existence is the only true release. Other systems assert, in flat contradiction of this view, the eternal persistence of the human soul, a basis of multiple consciousness in the one, or else a dependent but still separate entity. It is constant, real, imperishable. So these stand all against the materialistic viewpoint. The Buddhist simply denies the possibility of defining what is real, what is an entity, because everything is composed of elements, and the aggregate that seems to be a being can be dissolved. So where did that being go? And then the Advaitin says, but there is only one, after all, and so whatever you think to be partite is resolved back into that when you get the full flood of knowledge and you yourself disappear into the enormity of whatever that is. But that's not the only Vedantic view, although that's the one that is popularly related to Shankara, because the other Vedantic teachings, including those of the Trika school in Kashmir Shaivism and also Vishishtadvaita of Ramanuja, insist on the immortality of the human or individual soul, which carries within it the divinity from the Supreme. No, one does not become the Supreme in realizing and recognizing what one is, but one is released from ego and one feels identified with that Supreme. So it's a view that's very much more in line with Sri Aurobindo's perspective, which he will describe eventually. Amidst these various and conflicting opinions, the seeker of the truth has to decide for himself which shall be for him the knowledge. They all have a ground of truth. They are all an insight into a more complete reality. What is true for you? What is true for your soul? Sri Aurobindo is remarkably generous and liberal in his offering to the soul to find the path that suits it best. Why would he force somebody into his path? If you feel that renouncing the world is the way you must go, then that way you must go. But the larger work is to carry that realization with you into the world and see what you can do to share its divinity in every motion and every action that you undertake. But if our aim is a spiritual release or a spiritual fulfillment, then the exceeding of this little mold of ego is imperative. So however you describe knowledge, it is necessary that one peel away egoism, because it stops you from seeing what is. It is a fictional, fractional being, not drawn from the essence of things, but composed of transient elements. In human egoism and its satisfaction, there can be no divine culmination and deliverance. A certain purification from egoism is the condition even of ethical progress and elevation for social good and perfection. Much more is it indispensable for inner peace, purity, and joy. So you can see some of what he's about to write in The Psychology of Social Development is breathing into this essay on the synthesis of yoga. These larger ideas about how it is that society figures in the evolution of consciousness is now going to occupy his attention. The Psychology of Social Development eventually gets published as The Human Cycle, 1950. But a much more radical deliverance, not only from egoism, but from ego idea and ego sense, is needed if our aim is to raise human into divine nature. So you might be able to set aside the guise of egoism, and let's not belabor this, but you can get a sense of what you are, of your soul. You can let its power breathe into your life. But for a divine nature to become real, that means ego must go. The ego idea and the ego sense must go. This is not the bailiwick of the person beginning yoga. This is a far fulfillment. But we need to see that it is there. Experience shows that in proportion as we deliver ourselves from the limiting mental and vital ego, we command a wider life, a larger existence, a higher consciousness, a happier soul state, even a greater knowledge, power, and scope. So the ego is what captures us in the small. Even the aim, which the most mundane philosophy pursues, the fulfillment, perfection, satisfaction of the individual, is best assured not by satisfying the narrow ego, but by finding freedom in a higher and larger self. So there goes materialism. You can't gain satisfaction in the pursuit of quenching desire. It comes back more powerfully and finds a way of showing you that what you thought you gained, you just lost. So there's no way to make materialism the basis of a satisfying life. Everyone gets tired of piling up goods on the gross physical plane at some point and must quest on. The real quest is inner. So he takes us back to that and then says, well, let's read this. Even the aim, which the most mundane philosophy pursues, the fulfillment, perfection, satisfaction of the individual, so that would be siddhi, is best assured not by satisfying the narrow ego, living in the ahankara, but by finding freedom in a higher and larger self. So going actually beyond the highest poise of the buddhi, of the illumined mind, which is intuitive in its capacity. There is no happiness in smallness of the being, says the scripture. It is with the large being that happiness comes. So this is a quotation from the Chandogya Upanishad. This is in the seventh chapter, the seventh section, the 23rd chapter, and it's the first verse. It says, the large Bhuma is happiness. There is no happiness in smallness, alpam. Only Bhuma is sukham. Sukham is the word for happiness. So Bhuma, the large, the grand. What you might say is Lakshmi's native power, the universal, the capacious, that is happiness. That is satisfaction. The Upanishad goes on, continues and says, only Bhuma is sukham, but one must desire to know the large. Bhuma. One must desire to know, really know. We're in the yoga of knowledge. So then an answer comes to the person who is speaking. And he says, revered one, I aspire to know the vast. Vijignana. The vast, Bhuma. And This is Sanat Kumara instructing Narada, the great celestial sage who is full of love, who is full of aspiration, who is willing, as you know from other examples, to set aside his ego, to grow, to cast off one ego skin after another, because he wants that identity with the Supreme. So, if the ego holds you back, see you later, ego. So back to Sri Aurobindo. The ego is by its nature a smallness of being. It brings contraction of the consciousness, and with the contraction, limitation of knowledge, disabling ignorance, confinement, and a diminution of power, and by that diminution, incapacity and weakness, scission, the cutting, the division of oneness, and by that scission, disharmony and failure of sympathy and love and understanding, inhibition or fragmentation of delight of being, and by that fragmentation, pain and sorrow. So he's describing how the soul, itself a spark of Satchit Ananda, that conscious reality whose nature is delight, comes and in accepting its role in the universal play, accepting being embedded in matter, covered with limiting powers of life, blinking through an ignorant mind, develops and develops and grows, but on the way down, it has had to contract its consciousness because it was one with the Supreme. There are no walls there, but he has accepted with the ego this small definition of itself. Its being has been reduced to ego. Its power, its shakti, has been reduced to incapacity. Its delight has been rendered insentient and in the appearance of pain, sorrow, suffering. To recover what is lost, he says, we must break out of the walls of ego. The ego must either disappear in impersonality or fuse into a larger I. It must fuse into the wider cosmic I, which comprehends all these smaller selves, or the transcendent, of which even the cosmic self is a diminished image. So, one can go wide with the universe. One can go outside the universe to what is extra cosmic, large or small. Wherever you go, when you break the bonds of ego, you can only find Brahman. So, if all is Brahman, can you find it? And can you know it? Can you see it and understand it? Stand under it? Can you identify with it? This is the kind of knowledge that Sri Aurobindo is interested in, knowledge by identity. So the ego we drop so that we can become the larger self, which is cosmic in extent or transcendent of all differentiation in space and time. No determinations on that being. But this cosmic self is spiritual in essence and in experience. It must not be confused with the collective existence, with any group soul or the life and body of a human society or even of all mankind. No, the cosmic self is grand beyond measure. Perhaps I'll send to you an image of how an artist rendered the cosmic self, the great Purusha. The subordination of the ego to the progress and happiness of the human race is now a governing idea in the world's thought and ethics, but this is a mental and moral and not a spiritual ideal. And remember, he's writing just after World War I broke out. And so there's been this discussion in the idealistic 19th century about the progress of humanity and how we're on a march from light to greater light, except we weren't. And we discovered, nevertheless, how much darkness remained in the human cavern. For that progress is a series of constant mental, vital, and physical vicissitudes. It has no firm spiritual content and offers no sure standing ground to the soul of man. Right. So ethics and the amelioration of societal changes will not solve our central problem. Only arriving at the true self, defined individually, defined cosmically, defined transcendently, could offer us the true ground upon which we can stand. The consciousness of collective humanity is only a larger comprehensive addition or a sum of individual egos, made of the same substance, in the same mold of nature. It has not in it any greater light, any more eternal sense of itself, any purer source of peace, joy, and deliverance. It is rather even more tortured, troubled, and obscured, certainly more vague, confused, and unprogressive. The individual is, in this respect, greater than the mass and cannot be called on to subordinate his more luminous possibilities to this darker entity. The general mind has never been able to keep up with the pace of the leading mind. So we have bright souls who are always in the vanguard, and we have to give them space. This is the whole thrust of this idea about freedom of the individual, is that without that individual questing forward, we following don't achieve what otherwise we would. So this ego, as he wrote elsewhere, ego was the helper. Ego is the bar. When we as aspirants have grown to become aware of our egoism first can go, displaced perhaps by the power of the soul's effulgence as it comes forward, but the ego itself must go. And the only thing that can eradicate that is the larger realization of the self and the finalizing impact of the supramental consciousness, too. So I would just suggest that however we must gain release and cease identifying with the ego, the direct wrestling with it, trying to conquer it, trying to get it on the floor and pin it and win the wrestling match is not the way. Made of the same substance, in the same mold of nature, it has not in it any greater light, any more eternal sense of itself, any purer source of peace, joy, and deliverance. So what he's talking about here when he mentions the group soul, etc. Later he would use that term in a different way. Here, it's a general term. And he's suggesting that this cosmic self is a greater reality. Into that, we can leave the ego behind and find context. If light, peace, deliverance, a better state of existence are to come, they must descend into the soul from something wider than the individual, but also from something higher than the collective ego. Altruism, philanthropy, the service of mankind are in themselves mental or moral ideals, not laws of the spiritual life. If into the spiritual aim there enters the impulse to deny the personal self or to serve humanity or the world at large, it comes not from the ego, nor from the collective sense of the race, but from something more occult, hidden, and profound, transcendent of both these things. For it is founded on a sense of the divine in all, and it works not for the sake of the ego or the race, but for the sake of the divine and its purpose in the person or group or collective. This is pure Bhagavad Gita. This idea of its application to social development and the merging of a greater humanity is something that he will take up in that other essay, The Psychology of Social Development, and continue for a couple of years. But we're working towards a point where he's going to insist that even though we want to help lift the world up, you cannot achieve loka sangraha without first discovering what you are. You can't hold the worlds together if you're still chained to ignorance. You may have great goodwill. You may belong to the best political organizations with the farthest sight and all the resources and funds that are needed to make it work, but that is not what we're seeking for. We have to find the true being within and live from that. So we drop identification with body and its demands. We drop identification with desire nature and vital nature, and we drop identification with the mind and its preferences so that we can live from the soul and feel the inspiring radiance from above fill us, illumine us, lead us. We can be guided from within and from above. There can be this great synergy between the psychic and the spiritual, which can lead us towards a transformed personal and eventually social life. But if you don't do the work personally, the rest is a scheme on a chalkboard. It is this transcendent source which we must seek and serve, this vaster being and consciousness to which the race and the individual are minor terms of its existence, because that is real. And then it pours itself out as a cosmos, big as it is, as much as it dwarfs us. As the Rig Veda says, it's a fractional part, a quarter of the being. And let's not worry about the mathematics. It just means to say that the stupendous reality that is far beyond your reckoning. This world is small, and we are smaller than the world. So learn modesty. There is indeed a truth behind the pragmatic impulse which an exclusive one-sided spirituality is apt to ignore or deny or belittle. It is this, that since the individual and the universal are terms of that higher and vaster being, their fulfillment must have some real place in the supreme existence. There must be behind them some high purpose in the supreme wisdom and knowledge, some eternal strain in the supreme delight. They cannot have been, they were not created in vain. Sri Aurobindo takes an adamant stand here. This world is not a lie. It's not a cheat. It is real, and it is potentially beautiful. But the perfection and satisfaction of humanity, like the perfection and satisfaction of the individual, can only be securely compassed and founded upon a more eternal yet unseized truth and right of things. Minor terms of some greater existence, they can fulfill themselves only when that of which they are the terms is known and possessed. So again, if we're looking for assonances, then if there is a supreme person and the individual soul would represent the supreme person here, and if there is a cosmic all and the social complex in a sense would represent that all in human form, then there is purpose to it, but it becomes purposeful only when we get behind the appearances of things and don't identify with the false misleading forms, but live from the leading reality. And the leading reality is always the emerging individual soul, and let's get to the development of a group soul. Let's weld together a truly spiritual, harmonic form of collective humanity, whether it's a village, whether it's an ashram, whether it's a nation. The greatest service to humanity, the surest foundation for its true progress, happiness, and perfection, is to prepare or find the way by which the individual and the collective man can transcend the ego and live in its true self, no longer bound to ignorance, incapacity, disharmony, and sorrow. It is by the pursuit of the eternal and not by living bound in the slow collective evolution of nature that we can best assure even that evolutionary collective altruistic aim our modern thought and idealism have set before us. But it is in itself a secondary aim to find, know, and possess the divine existence, consciousness, and nature, and to live in it for the divine is our true aim and the one perfection to which we must aspire, to know the essence of true being. Now, Sri Aurobindo is inviting us to get back out of the ego into either the cosmic dimensioning of Atma Shakti or into the transcendence of the Atman, the Brahman, that which is supremely real. And he has phrased it in a large way. The large Brahma is happy, Sukham. The small is unhappy. But read this, that is from the Chandogya Upanishad. But just a couple of verses later, in the same Chandogya Upanishad, Sanat Kumara continues to instruct Narada and says, now, here, in this city of Brahman, the body, the life, the mind, the adhara. In this city of Brahman is an abode, a small lotus flower, Pundarika. Within it is a small space. What is within that should be sought. For that, truly, is what one should desire to know. So, you look beyond the ego, to the wideness of the world, and beyond that, to the transcendent. Escape the ego. Or escape the ego by discovering that the infinite is the very source of your being, deep inside. What is it that gives reality to this budding lotus within your heart space, behind your heart space? What is that that has no dimensionality, which is a mere point of light, a bindu, a drop? It is that drop of bliss that has come from there, has entered into this. Know that, and you gain freedom from ego. But Sri Aurobindo is absolutely right, and he's taking us on a larger context towards that vast, cosmic, transcendent. So we're sticking with him, yeah? But I wanted you to know about this other verse from the Chandogya, the singing Upanishad, the great chant. So we'll put a bookmark here, and we'll turn to Savitri. And since we're on the subject of the vast and of the regnant, of the emergence of the great soul, why don't we come to Book 1, Canto 3, The Yoga of the King, The Yoga of the Soul's Release. And we'll read some lines starting on page 22. A world's desire compelled her mortal birth. One in the front of the immemorial quest, protagonist of the mysterious play, in which the unknown pursues himself through forms and limits his eternity by the hours, and the blind void struggles to live and see, a thinker and toiler in the ideal's air, brought down to earth's dumb need her radiant power. His was a spirit that stooped from larger spheres into our province of ephemeral sight, a colonist from immortality, a pointing beam on earth's uncertain roads. His birth held up a symbol and a sign, his human self, like a translucent cloak, covered the all-wise who leads the unseeing world. Affiliated to cosmic space and time, and paying here God's debt to earth and man, a greater sonship was his divine right. Although consenting to mortal ignorance, his knowledge shared the light ineffable. A strength of the original permanence, entangled in the moment and its flow, he kept the vision of the vasts behind. A power was in him from the unknowable. An archivist of the symbols of the beyond, a treasurer of superhuman dreams, he bore the stamp of mighty memories and shed their grandiose ray on human life. His days were a long growth to the supreme, a skyward being nourishing its roots on sustenance from occult spiritual founts, climb through white rays to meet an unseen sun. His soul lived as eternity's delegate. His mind was like a fire assailing heaven, his will a hunter in the trails of light. An ocean impulse lifted every breath. Each action left the footprints of a god. Each moment was a beat of puissant wings. The little plot of our mortality, touched by this tenant from the heights, became a playground of the living infinite. This bodily appearance is not all. The form deceives, the person is a mask. Hid deep in man, celestial powers can dwell. His fragile ship conveys through the sea of years an incognito of the imperishable. A spirit that is a flame of God abides, a fiery portion of the wonderful, artist of his own beauty and delight, immortal in our mortal poverty. This sculptor of the forms of the infinite, this screened, unrecognized inhabitant, initiate of its own veiled mysteries, hides in a small dumb seed his cosmic thought. In the mute strength of the occult idea, determining predestined shape and act, passenger from life to life, from scale to scale, changing his imaged self from form to form, he regards the icon growing by his gaze, and in the worm foresees the coming God. At last, the traveler in the paths of time arrives on the frontiers of eternity. In the transient symbol of humanity draped, he feels his substance of undying self and loses his kinship to mortality. A beam of the eternal smites his heart. His thought stretches into infinitude. All in him turns to spirit vastnesses. His soul breaks out to join the oversoul. His life is oceaned by that super life. He has drunk from the breasts of the mother of the worlds. A topless supernature fills his frame. She adopts his spirit's everlasting ground as the security of her changing world and shapes the figure of her unborn mites. Namaste, Jai Ma.